How are you?
So far so good.
Okay, well, we've just started. Who knows what will go wrong? But I should introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and you are Carlos Stranger. That's as nearly as I can pronounce it.
That's perfectly fine.
Adequate, if not quite correct. You are in Israel. You are, first of all, you're a blogger for the newspaper Haaretz, which is sometimes called the New York Times of Israel. But in addition, and maybe more relevantly, since we're going to talk about your book, you are at Tel Aviv University, you're chair of the clinical graduate program in the Department of Psychology. Is that right?
That's
you're
correct,
a clinical
yes.
psychologist?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I basically my whole viewpoint is a combination between my two professional identities. One is clinical psychology, and I, for the first part of my career, I taught philosophy, actually, and I kind of try to integrate between the two, that's what I naturally have done throughout my career.
So your political blogging is organically connected to your teaching and your academic writing.
Yeah.
Kind of. So I wanted to talk about the book, and also, as long as you're in Israel and are an expert on that, if only by virtue of living there, but also by virtue of writing about its politics, I wanted to talk about Israel and maybe to some extent combine the two if that works. So talk about the psychology you talk about in your book as well as maybe the psychology of Israel. Now, the book is called The Fear of Insignificance, Searching for Meaning in the 21st Century. On Blogging Heads, as I think I told you, we take pride in never actually reading the books that we interview people about, but unlike people on NPR admitting it, but I did have a chance to at least skim it, so maybe I can at least try to characterize part of your argument, and then you can correct me as necessary.
Okay.
But it seems like you're doing a couple of things in the book. First of all, you're diagnosing a psychological malady or difficulty in individual human beings, or at least particular category of human beings who belong to a class that you call homo globalists, which you can talk about. Secondly, you're diagnosing a malady at the level of kind of global society, namely the inability of kind of the tribes, so to speak, to get along, various national, ethnic, religious, whatever groups. And then by the end of the book, you draw a connection between the two, I think. Or you have proposed solutions to the two that are related.
Yeah.
Have I got that right so far?
Yeah. Look, basically, my starting point is that the fear of insignificance is not something that emerged with Homo globalis, which is that species that we are becoming that's by virtue of our connection to the global infotainment system. It is a very primal fear that has emerged from what we know probably about 150,000 years ago when our species started to be aware of its own mortality. To the best of our knowledge, we're the only biological species, at least on Earth, that knows about its death. So that is that fear and the way of and our very basic need to deny our mortality is as old as mortality awareness. One of the most important aspects and one of the most important functions of all our cultural meaning systems has always been to create something that in existential psychology we call symbolic immortality. The sense of being part of something larger that it somehow bestows some form of immortality to us. What has mm-hmm. changed is that in an age in which a large part of humanity is connected to all the rest, it's become much more difficult to immunize meaning systems from the awareness that there are other competing meaning systems. The problem has always been around, but it's become almost impossible to deny that for Homo globalis.
So in the Middle Ages, for example, Christians in Europe lived largely in ignorance of the fact that in China they had a totally different belief system other than Christianity, for example.
Oh,
and now that's different? Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
It was certainly much easier, even if people knew about it, it was much easier to just say the other ones are barbarians. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. the very term barbarians, which is from the ancient Greeks, basically people who don't have a language. It was much easier to say the other meaning systems are obviously all ridiculous and false. Something mm-hmm. that's becoming progressively more difficult. And basically, I think that then we get to the point where you have the branches into two directions. Mm-hmm. The way of trying to salvage meaning is either of two. The one is what we see in the rise of fundamentalist movements in the last, pretty much in the same period as global communication has emerged. I see, along with many others, I see fundamentalism as a way of immunizing the meaning system from the threat of awareness of the others. You just mm-hmm. go into a bunker and you say, I know that there are others, but obviously my meaning system is the only one that's true and that really matters.
And it generally involves a sense of threat from the other system?
Yeah. The threat is there by the very fact that there are other meaning systems mm-hmm. because it makes it much more difficult to say my meaning system obviously must be the only one that is right, particularly the more you know about other meaning systems.
Okay.
So that's one direction. Then there is the other direction, which I think we see primarily in the free world, but not only in the free world, which is... Okay, if I know that the meaning systems, all these meaning systems don't have any absolute validity, and I still want to counter my own fear of insignificance mm-hmm. and the fear of my own mortality, I want an objective way of measuring my significance. And I think the phenomenon that I write about a lot is this enormous explosion that has been going on in the global media of rating and ranking scales of all sorts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it goes like this. If I can't rely on any of the traditional meaning systems, at least the numbers won't lie. And mm-hmm. then it becomes, I am rated, therefore I am. I'm rated.
Yeah, like one thing you hear about is like the ratio of your Twitter followers to the number of people you follow on Twitter. So a high ratio of followers to followed is considered a sign of greatness or something. I mean, that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right? A quantitative index of significance that often involving your online identity. Is that right?
I think it takes many forms. Begin mm-hmm. with the fact that, let's take probably the most famous rating scale, which is the Times 100 most influential people.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not on that, by the way, but go ahead.
Neither am I, so we have that much in common.
Yeah.
What I can tell you in the U.S. you have the Forbes list of the wealthiest, you have the largest mm-hmm. companies, the fastest growing companies, mm-hmm. and you have People magazine's the sexiest people, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
I'm not on that one either, by the way. But
well,
go ahead.
I, now you're pushing me, but I'll have to admit that I'm not on that one either.
Well, that's funny. I heard you were, but I must have been misinformed.
Yeah, you were misinformed.
Okay.
And I'll have to live with that as it seems. Anyway, what you see is that there is this total craze of trying to get ranked one way or another. By the way, I think one of the reasons for the immense popularity of Facebook is that mm-hmm. it basically enables all those that don't get into the radar, certainly not of the Time 100, but don't even, you know, have a Google rank mm-hmm. In Google mm-hmm. entries, and you're not going to be able to say now that there are no Google entries on you.
I can't quite say that.
No, you can't.
Almost no one. Increasingly, the number of people who can say that is dwindling.
Yeah.
And will continue.
Now, I guess it's beginning that if you have less than 50 or 100,000 entries of some sort, then you feel you're starting to feel uncomfortable. What Facebook has done is that basically all of us at least can count the number of friends we have on Facebook, and you can see it, by the way, from very early on. You see it with children and adolescents, the obsession with how many friends mm-hmm. they do have on Facebook. It's mm-hmm. kind of it is the proof of my existence. The fact mm-hmm. that somewhere in the web, my existence is reflected mm-hmm. in something that can be quantified.
Mm-hmm. I post, therefore I am, or something like that.
I post it, and even better, others post about me, therefore I am even more.
Therefore I am, yeah. Okay, so now, I mean, at a fundamental level, it's always been part of human nature to feel that you are held in high esteem by as many people as possible, even if in a hunter-gatherer society, say, that could only be, you know, a few dozen people, maybe. But you're saying that that there's something, I mean, is there something new about this? You're saying there's something new about this beyond the technological manifestation of it. You're saying the need itself has been intensified. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's not just that we're looking for different cues to our significance as conferred by social recognition. It's that the need for that kind of gratification has intensified, in your view.
Look, the need to, at the bottom of all this, and here I think the results of experimental existential psychology are very, very convincing, the need for some form of symbolic immortality has always been there. I mean, if you look at the Homeric heroes, the reason they want to do extraordinary acts of bravery is so people will sing about them forever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens is that for the Greek hero, it's kind of clear that the only thing that really matters is that the Greeks will sing about it. For a Roman, it didn't really matter, even if he knew about the existence of India, whether they would sing there.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is the moment that you become aware that your own immediate frame of reference is on a global scale not significant, then you're beginning to have a problem. Who needs to sing about me so I feel that I exist?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that's that the basic structure of the needs is new, but I think it's the awareness both of the global framework and I think in a sense also of modern cosmology. You suddenly realize that none of your immediate environment really matters on a global and certainly not on a cosmic scale. And that has created this craze. I want an objective proof that I matter.
Mm-hmm.
An objective proof, and that's in the numbers.
So you're saying that the bigger the world that we're aware of, the more inadequate we feel, in a sense, relative to the world that we're aware of. And there was a time when people were aware of a very small fragment of the world.
Yes, and now comes the second point. You see, the global infotainment system has its own logic. Since the media, in the moment media try to at least potentially reach a global audience, what they need are icons, people who are globally known, because those are the only ones that you have a chance that somebody in Japan, somebody in Bogota, and somebody in New York, and of course Tel Aviv, will know enough about to be interested about.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearest, of course, in the domain of advertising, where you need global celebrities if you want to have global brands. And the result is very simple and very logical. We are all flooded all the time by stories about global celebrities and absolutely extraordinary achievements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Everybody knows who Bill Gates is. Everybody knows who Steve Jobs is. Everybody knows mm-hmm. who Mark Zuckerberg is.
Mm-hmm.
And now, one of the things, if that fills that much of our horizon, then you get up in the morning and maybe you're, you know, like me, you're a professor of psychology, you've published X number of books and papers, and you give classes, and you see patients, and you write in papers. But what the hell is that compared to people who are literally known by the whole globe? And in some mm-hmm. cases, there is also, you know, really objective achievements. Take Sergey Brin and Larry Page. They have mm-hmm. literally changed the world within one decade. Literally changed the world. And then you say, what is what I do compared to people who've changed the world completely? When Steve Jobs comes out with a new product, mm-hmm. It changes the way people live. It changes the way they consume the media. And since these stories get pumped through the infotainment system all the time, mm-hmm. on the one hand, we want objective proof for our value as human beings. And on the other hand, this value is for 99.99999% of all of us. And this value seems absolutely,
unattainable or
insignificant compared to the stories that we read.
Yeah. So now, a hundred years ago, people were aware of other people who had achieved things that for them were unachievable. You know, presidents, great scientists, great writers. So what you're if you're saying there's something fundamentally new, you're talking in part just about how pervasively we are flooded, our awareness is flooded with information about these people. That's the big thing you think.
Again, I think that the basic psychology, you know, the basic psychology is a function of our biological hardware, and that hasn't changed in the last mm-hmm. 30 years. I just think that the environmental conditions and the cultural implications have created something that I think is something of a quantum leap.
Okay. And before we get to what your proposed solution to the problem is or what you're recommending to people, I gather you've used the term existential. I gather you come out of the existentialist tradition. And I've never known as much about that as I should know. I gather you discuss it a little in your book, and I gather it has the existential kind of you hear the term existential dread or whatever. I gather that according to existentialism, a big problem with human psychology is one thing that you've already mentioned, mortality. Combined the awareness that we're going to die, combined with the awareness that we're making choices and have made choices that kind of increasingly seal our fate, so to speak. In other words, constrain or help determine what it is we're capable of getting done before we die, and or something like that, right?
Yes.
Is that what the existentialist philosophers were talking about?
That is, I think, a very concise and very precise summary of the core ideas of existential thoughts. It's quite interesting that existentialism has kind of lost much of its... it was very much in the 1950s, the 1960s, and it then kind of drizzled away, I think, because our culture is not good at dealing with limitations. And existentialism mm-hmm. is about what our basic structural limitations in life, our finitude, our mortality, the fact that choices that we make obviously lead to the point where we cannot make, we have denied ourselves the choices that we didn't take. Our culture is not good at accepting this. And mm-hmm. what's so interesting for me is that in the last 20 years or so, what before was basically a set of philosophical theses has become a part of an experimental discipline that has shown that many of the basic tenets of existential thought are actually empirically verifiable, and that indeed they show how much our attempt to deal with our finitudes and to deny it in a way or in one way or another are one of the deepest motivators of the human psyche.
Mm-hmm. And so your idea is that although this the kind of the existential problem precedes the internet has intensified it for some people, or the modern infotainment complex or whatever has intensified it for some people, because it raises the stakes. It isn't just that time is running out and you've already made these decisions that constrain your ability to achieve something immortal. It's that you're more and more aware as at the same time of all these people who have come so much closer than you could ever come to attaining immortality.
Let's go one step further. Our culture is obsessed with youth. One of the reasons, by the way, is don't forget that one of the enormous implications of technological changes is that today images are can be distributed globally within no time. Now, obviously, for purely biological reasons, in terms of what we like to see visually, we prefer youth to age. So, what intensifies our fear is the sense that if you hadn't done something absolutely spectacular at a very early age, you've already missed out. Think about how much Mark Zuckerberg preoccupies people, but even more. You see, most people care less about great achievement. They care about being loved, and that means fame. And obviously, most of the global celebrities are young people who at a very early age become immensely famous and immensely wealthy, and everybody wants to know every detail about their lives. And, you know, it's a very basic human wish. We all once were the center of the universe, a fairly small universe of our family, but and then we realized we're not the center of anything. And I think celebrity becomes a symbol of the idea that, A, I can be famous for everybody and forever, and I can be loved just for the fact of existing. People will want to know everything about me all the time. Now, that increases, increases our fear, our fears that are not new, immensely, because, for example, the idea is, what you haven't done by the age of 35 no longer matters. So our culture has many ways of intensifying these fears.
Okay. And you, the phrase you use, homo globalis, that is, I mean, what I was going to say was, surely there are lots of people who never dream of rivaling a Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Yep.
And for them, at least at a conscious level, they just don't see themselves in the same league. So I'm wondering, when you talk about this malady as afflicting members of the category you call homo globalis, you're talking about a socioeconomic subset of the whole world's population? Are you talking about relatively well-educated people with access to technology who have a reason to have, you know, higher than average aspirations? That's mainly who you're talking to and about?
No. One of the phenomena I analyzed there is reality TV, which is one of the the enormous phenomena. The more educated ones, the more gifted ones say, okay, I want to have an achievement that will put me on the global map. But you see it with people who have all you need is an internet connection or cable TV. And then the dream, it's amazing. You see more and more research that shows that when you ask youngsters, what do you want to be when you're going to be big? The answer is, I want to be famous.
Yeah.
And reality.
That is an interesting product of not just reality TV, but YouTube culture. You're right. We are now in a world where people who you would not predict celebrity or fame or great accomplishment for can become very, very widely known in a short period of time. Yep. So you're saying that's a key thing in spreading this aspiration to kind of socioeconomic sectors that it might not have existed to in an earlier age.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you see.
Go ahead.
Please.
What's your recommended solution? I mean, what do you advise us? I know in the book you talk about various kind of self-help solutions that are on the marketplace, and I think you see a connection there between your diagnosis and this demand for new age spirituality and all kinds of things. But what do you recommend? What should I do?
If you don't mind, Bob, I'd like to step back for a minute and look at the other. I say there is a basic bifurcation. Maybe before we get to the solution, we should look at another aspect of the problem, which very much connects to also my political writing, because I think the Middle East is special in many ways, but is primarily special because it is the epicenter of all three major what they call
Abrahamic religions.
And what we see on a macro scale, there is a whole very, very large segment of, actually the majority of humanity, tries to solve the problem that we're talking about, not by going for celebrity and wealth, but by saying, I have a meaning system that promises me not symbolic immortality, but literal immortality. This is, by the way, one of the reasons why, if you look at meaning systems the way Dawkins does, as memes, as cultural units that compete for minds to infect, so to speak, religions have an enormous evolutionary advantage over other systems because they promise something that no other system can give. And but now comes the problem. If I'm Jewish or if I'm a Muslim or if I'm a Christian and I say, okay, I can get immortality by being a devout one of the three, let's say, let's leave out the zillions of other religions that are around right now, then, okay, my problem is solved, but it isn't. What about the other ones? Should I live according to the codex of the 630 do's and don'ts of Judaism, or should I go to church, or do I have to pray to Allah five times a day? Now, since this is literally a matter of life and death, one of the things that we've been seeing is a very strong rise in the attempt to just immunize your own meaning system from others. Now, it doesn't matter whether we talk about Al-Qaeda at one total extreme, Hamas to or Hezbollah to take another a slightly less extreme form. Al-Qaeda is totally fascinating because it has a totally apocalyptic worldview which shows something very clearly. See, suicide terrorism of that sort shows that people are willing to sacrifice their actual lives for the certainty of immortality. In other words, immortality is more important than life. Now, when we go to less extreme examples that can be, you know, any variety, there are all the varieties of Christian fundamentalisms, fundamentalism that you have in the U.S. We have, let's say, the national religious movement here in Israel that says it doesn't matter what the international community wants. It doesn't matter what happens to the Palestinians. We believe that this piece of land has been promised to us by God, and nothing, absolutely nothing, will influence the way we see the world. Mm-hmm. So what we see is a very powerful, and in terms of sheer quantity, much more influential way of trying to deal with our dread of insignificance. And quite unfortunately, this is a way of dealing with it that literally may not just lead to the death of this or that suicide bomber, but may, one way or another, lead to the extinction of humanity. My friend Scott Atran, whom I quote a number of times in the book, has interviewed major figures in Islamic terrorism, who are utterly mm-hmm. convinced that it is their religious duty to kill at least 4 million women and children in the U.S. With an atomic device. And when he asked him, "But are you aware that this could lead to the extinction of the Ummah, of the Islamic world, because the retaliation would be horrendous?" So the answer is that doesn't matter. I know what my duty is. It's Allah is going to take care of the rest, and it'll depend on His will. And through my, I'm part of a terrorism research group. I can tell you that this danger, unfortunately, is very real. It's not a figment of paranoid imagination.
And you're saying it is intensified by awareness of the other religions.
Yes, because in a sense, when you have no way of running away, you see, well, the big, right. When you look at what Al-Qaeda is really saying, Al-Qaeda is saying we have to cleanse. We can't deny the existence of the West. So what they say is we have to cleanse Islam of the impact of the West, and cleanse it by all means that we can use.
Let me ask you: do you think the appeal of this ideology to people is also intensified by threats in a more concrete sense? In other words, like if there's an occupying army or something. I mean, there's a lot of research connecting terrorism to that, right? And in fact, Osama bin Laden's original grievance, right, was focused on the rulers of Saudi Arabia, and it was because there were American troops in Saudi Arabia that apparently he decided to focus so many resources on America. So I mean, I would, and I guess I'm thinking partly just of your identity as a blogger. I would guess that you would. From what I've read of you, I would guess that you would agree that there's some influence from that kind of sense of threat as well, but maybe you won't.
Well, I would differentiate very strongly between movements like Hamas, which have a concrete political goal, and movements like Al-Qaeda. I'm basically, I very much belong to the liberal spectrum of views.
Right.
I think the weakness of the liberal viewpoint is that it often denies that there are problems that cannot simply be taken care of by being nice. Mm-hmm. I think that groups like Al-Qaeda, that from what we know, it really doesn't depend on this or that grievance. I can tell you that Al-Qaeda has at some point, taken a ride on the Palestinian issue, but
right.
We know from interviews that if you go to Waziristan, most of them wouldn't even know where Palestine is located.
Right.
It's much more a deep, profound sense that of desperately looking for some sort of meaning, and only finding it in a very radicalized worldview. It's not just a matter of this or that injustice. You know, Osama bin Laden is as you know, comes from a very wealthy family, and he had plenty of other options except going for the type of career that he did.
Mm-hmm. But, well, I guess what I would say is, I mean, you seem to be distinguishing between Hamas as a kind of a strategic, kind of organization that uses violence instrumentally in service of its strategic goals. And Al-Qaeda, which is more broadly apocalyptic, I guess maybe the question I'm asking is, isn't it the case, though, that in Gaza, where Hamas operates, the appeal to some young men of the more apocalyptic, more fanatical, less instrumental use of violence is intensified by their sense of concrete threat.
Absolutely.
So the spread of the apocalyptic ideology is influenced by things ranging from occupation to a sense of just kind of cultural threat.
Yes, let's look at some of the Christian fundamentalist groups in the U.S., many of whom have a very apocalyptic worldview. Their theology actually goes, say, that at some point, one of the reasons, for example, there's really not much use in preserving nature is because the world's going to come to an end very soon anyway. Now, many of these people have absolutely no grievances whatsoever. Many of them are very well off, and as you know, some very powerful sponsors of these groups are immensely wealthy. So I think it's while I certainly don't deny that in certain that some of these phenomena have to do with actual grievances, like Israeli occupation. In many cases, I think it is very, very different.
I would argue that with Christian fundamentalists, and I know a few, there is a sense of threat. It's not a sense of territorial threat. It's a sense of cultural threat. It's parents having one set of values and feeling that their children's minds are being infiltrated by a broader culture that they have trouble controlling, and that's what leads them to homeschool their children, for example. So I think,
Bobby,
and this is not
this
a thesis.
Exactly. This is we're exemplifying
right.
my thesis.
Yeah,
precisely.
I see the merging of these two kinds of explanations now. I see that in a way, you know, what your thesis is about a sense of cultural threat in a certain sense.
It's not a grievance what you see here in the, let's say, the Tea Partiers, the sense that America is being taken away from them. Now, one of the things that connects between many Christian fundamentalists in the U.S. and people like, with all the differences, of course, like Osama bin Laden, is that today's technology makes it impossible for them to shield their culture from outside influence. Mm-hmm. And the reason the U.S. is so much in the center of the U.S., by the way, in these frameworks, it's always the U.S. and the Jews. And the reason is that the U.S. and the Jews are perceived as having an immense influence over culture and the entertainment system, and that hence they if you remember in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, this character who said, they're contaminating our precious body with fluids. Okay? Yeah. The fear of contamination of one's culture is enormous. And it's, I think, too easy to think that it's just a matter of grievances, of actual misdoings or being disadvantaged in one way or another in all cases.
Yeah, no, what I would say is it's a sense of, and this is not original to me. I think maybe this is a thesis of Karen Armstrong's, I'm not sure, but there's always a sense of threat, and the threat can be material, it can be boots on your ground, but it can also be a sense of cultural threat.
I see, by the way, I don't take any credit for this thesis. I think the first who actually put the point very powerfully was actually Benjamin Barber in his Jihad versus
McWorld.
Yeah, which I think is to this day an absolutely excellent book, and it was amazingly prescient because it was written in the 90s. What I'm doing is I'm trying to give an explanatory framework that explains the whole, that tries to connect between that and the phenomena like the rise of reality TV and the obsession that people have with rankings and ratings. That basically it, in the end, goes back to the same primal fear of being intimidated.
Okay. And we should, to make sure we don't run out of time without people knowing what they should do in response to the affliction that they may or may not have realized before this, that they suffer from, before you explain to them that they suffer from this affliction, what should we all do?
Okay.
To stave off this the existential problem that has been intensified by modern technology.
I think that one of the things that we first of all we have to be aware of the powers that that influence us, and mm-hmm. see that I have worked with a lot of I only work with successful people or celebrities. I've worked with a lot of. What I can tell you is that the fantasy that people have, that if your rating goes into the sky, your fear will go away, is completely wrong. If you have the number one show, you live with the constant panic that tomorrow you won't have it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, I can tell you that, you know, people who work in magazines that do rankings of that sort will tell you that they're being driven nuts by the PR people of the rich and successful. It just can't be that the rating of my or ranking of my client is going to go down this year. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, the alternative that I propose has two aspects. One of them is that I think that what we know empirically is that what gives people a sense of actual meaning is where they're immersed in something that they like to do, that they value, and mm-hmm. that they have invested a lot in. And the sense of immersion, together with the sense of the coherence of your own life. You know, we don't say that a Picasso is better or less good than a Cezanne, based on how much they fetched on in last Sotheby auction. We look at the inner mm-hmm. coherence of that work of art, and I think that all of us know moments, periods in which we feel that our lives have an internal coherence, that with all the ups and downs, we see an inner logic of how things have evolved, even though it's never a linear product. You see, one mm-hmm. of the things that I like about the existentialist point of view is that it says running away from tragedy, and there is something inherently tragic in human existence, in the existence of an animal that has suddenly become aware of its mortality. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, I speak in evolutionary terms. It's not... if we accept that this tragedy is an essential aspect of our lives, and we embrace it instead of trying to run away from it, mm-hmm. then we are able, both in our personal lives and in our professional lives, to have many, many more moments or periods, but also, in the way we experience our lives as a whole, to say they have an intrinsic meaning. And that the meaning is not a matter of comparing it to others, because the comparative meaning is one that is always, by its very logic, under threat. Mm-hmm. So, in a nutshell, that's one aspect of what I'm trying to say, and that means, among others, that we need to find ways to be less phobic about our mortality. And, you know, I don't claim much originality for that either. You have it in Plato, you have it in particular in the Stoics and the Epicureans, and almost every major philosophy, by the way, not just Western philosophies, Eastern philosophies as well, have always said that if you want to live well, you have to be able to live with the thought of death. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, again, if we try to run away with, by, for example, by piling achievements up upon each other, that basic mm-hmm. fear is not going to go away.
Of course, not everyone is trying to pile achievements on one another, which I think it, in some sense or another, is almost everyone. Not everyone has a conscious connection with awareness of death, right? I mean, and maybe your philosophy doesn't depend on that. I don't know enough about existential philosophy, but I mean, just take myself. I don't think about death much. I do think about achievement sometimes, and I, you know.
Robert, you take it. Yes. It's very interesting. I'm not going to psychoanalyze you now. Don't worry.
Well, I feel like I was just put on a couch. There was something about your tone of voice.
Yeah, I know.
Me feel like I'm getting $100 an hour worth of counseling for free. So go ahead. It's a bargain.
No.
Help me out.
First of all, I'm not going to send you a bill. And
that's what I mean. That's why bring it on.
What is interesting is that for you, you kind of took it for granted now that people try to pile achievements onto each other. And I don't think that's a
matter. Maybe it's just the people I know. Maybe I'm hanging out with a bad crowd. But
you know, there are people who don't feel that much pressure to do that. Quite unfortunately, mm-hmm. I'm not among them, okay?
Yeah.
I try to do what I can to find as many moments as I can of living the present. Because mm-hmm. the sense that I need to justify my existence, mm-hmm. That's what runs behind this idea that I have to pile up achievements to in the end look at the Google entries, at the books I've written, at the people that have written reviews about me, or whatever, or the people that watched mm-hmm. movies that I was in, depending on the career, you take it for granted that that's the way it is. I don't think it is.
I think you're right. My daughter just got back from Peru, where she's in high school, and she was there as an exchange student for a few mm-hmm. weeks, and she was struck by how different the culture was there.
Yeah.
And they were the people she was with were socioeconomically comparable in the Peruvian context, mm-hmm. probably, to her friends here, but there was much less emphasis on achievement and much more emphasis on nourishing social bonds, social relationships. So you're right. Mm-hmm. My view is a skewed one. I mean, I do think people everywhere want to be held in high esteem by someone, right?
Yes.
But it's a question of how they define the circle and how realistic the aspiration is.
And not just that, I would say, again, if you get up in the morning, look, I'm not arguing against trying to achieve. I'm not arguing mm-hmm. against trying to do things that have meaning and that do something good for, and you know, that have impact, etc. I'm talking a bit about the fact that much of this has become an endless panic, mm-hmm. and that's first of all, I think we really have to become aware of that. And when you said before, oh my God, now you sound as if you're putting me on a couch. This isn't about you or about me. I mean, I haven't written this book about you and me. I've written about the many tens and hundreds of millions who suffer from this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second thing that I have said is I am struck, and that's the part where I really do address a more highly educated audience. I am struck by how people who are well educated, who have a lot of resources of many sorts, when it comes to investment in their worldviews, they have a supermarket mentality, and mm-hmm. they think that what will give them some peace and quiet is something that they can take off the shelf and do a 7-day course mm-hmm. prescribed by the latest guru, and it will do the job. And I think that it runs very deep, because I think, well, I don't want to go into that now, but there is a certain relativism that has been pervasive in particularly in American culture, but not only. for the last decades. And people think it doesn't really matter. I can take a little bit of Kabbalah, sprinkle it with some Indian astrology, and add some Buddhism inside, and put it into the blender, and I'll feel great the day.
Well, but if it works for them, is that not okay?
It doesn't. That's the
point. Oh, it doesn't.
The point is, if it did,
yeah.
What you see is, if this worked, it wouldn't. Mm-hmm. This whole industry of pop spirituality thrives on the fact that it doesn't work, and that means that there will always be room for the next guru who will say, "But I have the ultimate enlightenment, and I will tell you how to do it, and I will tell you how to do it in 3 days."
Mm-hmm.
It's this quick fix mentality that I think has, what statistics show is that people become junkies of these books. If they would work, they would say...
Whereas in your view, they should become junkies of this book instead, right? This is the book they should be junkies of. They're junkies of the wrong books. That's where they went wrong.
You know what? If I thought... I've spent, in addition to the other things that I do, you know, the writing, the research, etc., I've spent more than 20,000 hours in my adult life professionally helping people. I think my message here is, it's really fascinating when it comes to physical fitness. It's clear to everybody that there are no quick fixes.
Mm-hmm.
You work on it, you build a certain resilience. You'll have to work at it, on it forever. Otherwise, it'll go away. When it comes to the most basic issues of our existence, people think that it can be, you know, taken off a shelf, integrated within a week, and I'll finally get peace and quiet. And basically, what mm-hmm. I'm saying, and again, by the way, I don't claim any originality for that. All great philosophical traditions have said that working on... I don't even word of work. I no longer use the term spirituality because it's become so cheapened by mm-hmm. this pop spirituality supermarket. So I would call it rather dealing with ultimate existential concerns is something that we need to train ourselves in. By immersing ourselves in texts and in cultural traditions that are mm-hmm. a lot more difficult, and it's something that we need to work on as a lifelong project, because otherwise what will happen is that you'll feel, wow, I found the guru, and 2 weeks later and you'll say, oh, it was wrong, I'm looking for the next one, mm-hmm. instead of really building something that has internal coherence, is intellectually viable, and mm-hmm. does give us much more aesthetic and existential and intellectual fulfillment than all these quick mm-hmm. fixes.
Okay. Now we're running out of time, so let me, there's a couple of issues I want to get to quickly. So let me just ask you for, a capsulized answer to a couple of questions. The first is to, if you could make explicit, although I kind of get the sense, make explicit the connection between this diagnosis you've made of this individual malady and the problem of the world's kind of tribes again, religious tribes, what national tribes, whatever, getting along, right? What is the connection between the solution to those two problems?
Well, here I go one step further, and here I will, I very gratefully admit that your own thought has played an important role here, because I think that the idea of the non-zero principle is one of those ideas, you know, when you get it, it's quite stunning how deep it runs and how much mileage you can get out of it. One of the things that I have... That I'm working on is a question: is it possible to build what I call a psychology of world citizenship? Mm-hmm. Is it possible, instead of feeling that only my tribe can give me meaning, and my tribe's meaning is at the expense of another tribe's meaning, that we develop something like a real awareness that it's not a mushy idea that we all should all love each other, but mm-hmm. that interdependence, global interdependence, has gotten to the point where developing, there is difficulty. We're all part of Homo globalis. World citizenship is that type of state of mind that needs a lot of work. It needs mm-hmm. to really, you need to really internalize what our situation is, as situation as humans is today. And that the adoption of universalist values out of, as you say, enlightened self-interest, not out of some kind of mushy spirituality, is something that has one enormous advantage. In addition to maybe, that it may possibly save our species from self-extinction, it has the advantage that you live in a meaning system that is not threatened by other meaning systems. That in a sense connects between all of us. And again, I'm not saying this, you know, in some vague, mushy way, but the opposite. You need to, when you look at economics, when you look at ecology, when you look at strategic studies, when you look at terrorism, you suddenly begin to realize that this is very real, and that dealing with this is a part of a meaning system that is far less likely to be threatened by the next fad or the next religion or some other religion than the other ones that are around. Mm-hmm. And I think this is, in a sense, it's a proposal that very hopefully, if you know, some discussion will arise about around this. I think there are very concrete implications about how we should educate, about what kind of mental abilities we need to train children, adolescents, and our students at universities in order to gain this kind of ability for world citizenship. It's not an abstract idea, but something that in the end has very concrete implications that I'm not going to go into now. But it means that it could be an action program that can both be very helpful for our species and give meaning to many, many of us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me, we should have another one of these conversations because we are running out of time and there's so much here to cover. Let me ask you the final question, if only because I promised at the beginning that I would get into the subject of Israel a little. Yeah. And let me ask for just your capsulized kind of analysis of Israel's psychology to the extent that you're willing to oversimplify and do a kind of, you know, talk about a national psychology. But let me preface it with an observation that I would think, you know, that the crisis of existential meaning at the individual level would be less acute in Israel because there is the perception of an existential threat in a more literal level. Right. I mean, there are many people who think the very survival of the Israeli nation is imperiled. You've heard the term existential threat applied to Israel a lot, in particular in the context of Iran and its nuclear program. But I think more broadly, there is a sense of kind of siege. There is a sense that Israel is you know, surrounded by enemies and that its very identity cannot be taken for granted. So I would have thought that you know, that there would be less, that the one kind of existential threat would lessen the other kind of sense of existential crisis, if you see what I mean. Well, but that's not, if you don't want to answer that question,
I can try to answer it in a nutshell. Yeah. What you see is that, particularly the more religious strata of Israeli society, even though not only those, actually tends towards, I was talking about the bifurcation, okay? Whether mm-hmm. you go into the tribal direction or into the universalist direction. They take a more tribal approach, which, by the way, is what our psychology pushes us to do. And the threat, mm-hmm. we tend to go to our own tribe. And mm-hmm. quite unfortunately, a large percentage of Israelis, because of the sense of threat that they're in, pulled towards a more tribal sense that nobody understands us. They don't understand mm-hmm. that we're under existential threat. We can no longer listen, and we're all alone, and we have to deal with this on our own. With quite unfortunate, it's very, and I think it was primarily a function of the Second Intifada at the beginning of 2000 to 2003, and then the shelling from Gaza. What I think people from outside don't understand is how deep that sense of threat in Israel mm-hmm. for many Israelis, for most Israelis, actually is. People like myself. Believe that the only way out of this is to go for win-win situations. In other words, what most people in Israel think is that the situation, at least between us and the Palestinians, is a win-lose situation, that there is no way out of it. I think on mm-hmm. our side, there's still a liberal elite that is quite strong, but unfortunately politically not powerful today, that thinks that the only way out is to build win-win situations. Quite fortunately, mm-hmm. at least in the West Bank, people like Mahmoud Abbas and Salam Fayyad are trying to go exactly in the same direction. But it's very difficult to convince Israelis at this point that this is viable. The mm-hmm. trauma of there was the hope in the 1990s that the Oslo process would lead to peace. When it fell mm-hmm. apart in the Second Intifada, it really led Israelis to say there is no solution, and anybody who says there is a solution is selling us crap and endangering our children. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what we are at this point, and that's what it explains the rise of nationalism and of right-wing parties in Israel in the last decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that like other parts of this conversation, leaves us a lot to talk about in a future conversation.
I will be very happy to do that.
But I will hold up the book one more time. And I guess in closing, if you want to comment on the significance of that that image, the guy is holding his umbrella where the rain isn't, or at least he's holding it in a place where he's not going to defend himself against the rain.
We have spoken a lot about the ways in which we try to defend ourselves against our basic fears in precisely the wrong ways.
Yeah, okay. Well, then it makes sense. So, well, thanks again, Carlo, for trying this, and I hope you'll good luck with the book, and I hope we'll do this again before long.
Will be a great pleasure. Thanks a lot to you.
Okay, take care.